ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் மொனாஸ்டிக் மிஷன், குருதேவா ஆன் ஷம், அண்ட் வாட் இஸ் ஹிந்துயிசம், பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
Nice email from a young man who's interested in domestic life, 20-year-old in the U.S., sent me unsolicited a list of his 10 desires. Don't know what his 10 desires are? It is my desire to know God. It is my desire to worship God. It is my desire to serve God. It is my desire to serve God's creation. It is my desire to mingle with holy company. It is my desire to bow before the Guru's feet. It is my desire to do His will. It is my desire to renounce the past. It is my desire to renounce myself. It is my desire to renounce my desires. All 10 of them. That was sweet. So I sent him back a note, a quote from Gurudeva on Hinduism. No other faith boasts such a deep and enduring comprehension of the mysteries of existence, or possesses so vast a metaphysical system. The storehouse of religious revelations in Hinduism cannot be reckoned. I know of its equal nowhere. Contains the entire system of yoga, of meditation and contemplation and self-realization. Nowhere else is there such insightful revelation of the inner bodies of man, the subtle pranas in the chakras, or psychic centers within the nerve system. Inner states of superconsciousness are explored and mapped fully in Hinduism. From the clear white light to the sights and sounds which flood the awakened inner consciousness of man, in the West, it is the mystically awakened. In the West, it is the mystically awakened soul who is drawn to Hinduism for understanding of inner states of consciousness, discovering after ardent seeking that Hinduism possesses answers which do not exist elsewhere, and is capable of guiding awareness into ever deepening mind strata. Isn't that beautiful? That's really nice. Strong statement on Hinduism from Gurudeva. So I ran across the mission of the mission recently. Gurudeva put everything in the trilogy, even instructions to the monks, just so we wouldn't lose them, wouldn't forget them. Have to read them once a year at least. So this one's from Living with Shiva. The mission of the mission. The legacy of Devas from the entire parampara accompanies our monastic order, providing silent, unseen inner guidance and The legacy of Devas from the entire parampara accompanies our monastic order, providing silent, unseen inner guidance and protection for old and young alike. As long as at least one person within the entire group of Madhavasis is going into and coming out of Parashiva once a day, the doorway to the third world remains open to the hereditary entourage of demonic forces that has been building up for over 2,000 years. So that's a very interesting statement. Shows the importance of striving to realize the self, certainly, because it's saying that the whole key to holding this parampara inner lineage of beings is a monastic experience in Parashiva. And that the demonic forces have been building up for over 2,000 years. This is because the Brahma Rantra, the door of Brahman at the top of the head, remains open when Parashiva is daily experienced within a Madhavasi community. It could be within the oldest monk or within the youngest. This great realization occurring time and time again within someone day after day keeps the door of Brahma open for the entire Brahmachakravala of monastics, keeping vibrantly strong the inner actinic connection with all gurus of our parampara, as well as with other sadhus, rishis, and saints who have reached these same attainments, and with the sapta rishis themselves who guide our order from deep within the inner locus. And Gurudeva goes on talking about swamis and sannyas. My Saiva Swamis or Nada Swamis are distinguished by their orange robes, gold Nada earrings, and three strands of Rudraksha beads. They are the Saiva Siddhanta Yoga order known as the Saiva Swami Sangam when they gather in ecclesiastical conclave. Sangam does not follow the protocol of unanimous decision. Rather, it works in intuitive one-mindedness to carry out instructions from the Kailasapidam, our spiritual seat of authority, to better the Saivite mission and the individuals dedicated to its success. These sannyasins are not looked upon as individuals so much as an integrated council, assembled and working in unison to perform a holy work, Sivanadiyaras, servants of God Shiva. Guided by the Satguru, the Saiva Swami Sangam forms the ecclesiastical body of our Hindu church, which works in a humble way to protect the purity of the faith among all Hindu sects, through inspiring publications and other means of encouragement. Specifically, our order's mission is to protect, preserve, and promote the Saivite Hindu religion as embodied in the Tamil culture, traditions, and scriptures of South India and Sri Lanka. The monastic order follows a cenobitic pattern in which monastics live in community, work together toward common objectives. Sannyasins of this order are not wandering sadhus or silent contemplatives, known as anchorites. Rather, they are members of a brotherhood working closely and industriously with their satguru and with their brother monastics. At the time of sannyasa diksha, each has accepted the mission of the Kailasa Parampara as his own, to protect and perpetuate Saivism, to serve Hindus the world over, to provide, teach, and disseminate scriptures, religious literature, and practical instruction, to promote temple construction and to exemplify the dignity and enlightenment of our Nandinava Sampradaya. Living under lifetime vows of renunciation, humility, purity, confidence, and obedience, these sannyasins are bound to fulfill their unique role in the Saiva culture of religious exemplars and staunch defenders of the faith. Their ideal is to balance outward service, Sivathondu, and inward contemplation, realization, siddhiyana, for a rich, fulfilling, and useful life. Well, that's a beautiful statement. It reminds us all of what we're doing here for these families, and there's preparation for something else. Well, that stays. We read the definition of moksha, which is moksha comes when earthly karma has been resolved, karma well performed, and God fully realized. So, one of the lessons that went by in the last week was appropriate development of that. Dancing with Shiva Sloka 50. Should one avoid worldly involvement? The world is the bountiful creation of a benevolent God who means for us to live positively in it, facing karma and fulfilling dharma. We must not despise or fear the world. Life is meant to be lived joyously. Om Namah Shivaya. The world is the place where our destiny is shaped, our desires fulfilled, and our soul matured. In the world we grow from ignorance into wisdom, from darkness into light, and from a consciousness of death to immortality. The whole world is an ashrama in which all are doing sadhana. We must love the world, which is God's creation. Those who despise, hate, and fear the world do not understand the intrinsic goodness of all. The world is a glorious place not to be feared. It is a gracious gift from Shiva himself, a playground for his children in which to interrelate young souls with the old, the young experiencing their karma, while the old hold firmly to their dharma. The young grow, the old know. Not fearing the world does not give us permission to become immersed in worldliness. To the contrary, it means remaining affectionately detached, like a drop of water on a lotus leaf, being in the world but not of it, walking in the rain without getting wet. The Vedas warn, behold the universe in the glory of God and all that lives and moves on earth. Leaving the transient, find joy in the eternal. Set not your heart on another's possession. So that develops that idea quite nicely. Also mentions one of Gurudeva's important themes, life is meant to be lived joyously. And I always like to mention that a few times a year, just to remind us. Sometimes we get too serious, don't laugh enough, smile enough. But that's not what's intended. Those of you who've heard me say it before, remember I distinguish between being serious and being somber. Somber is you never smile. Because we're pursuing something serious, which is sadhana. It's not going to smile. We can be serious, meaning trying to live a strict life, without being somber. They don't have to go together. So that's where Gurudeva spirit, as might be shown in the photo up there. It certainly doesn't look somber. Life is meant to be the joyful. So it's something we were talking about in our classes on meditation. Claiming our state of consciousness, that's part of the idea. If you haven't studied consciousness and awareness and haven't given much thought to meditation, then the states of consciousness we experience during the day are very much subject to how the world is treating us. If someone is treating us poorly, giving us a bad time, or we've lost things and we can't find them, or we've lost a computer file we spent a week creating, you know, whatever, we tend not to be joyous. But there's no reason not to. No matter what's going on in our life, our state of consciousness doesn't have to be dependent upon that. So if people are treating us well or people are treating us poorly, if the day is going well or poorly, we really don't have to let that determine the state of consciousness we're experiencing, which is what lots of people do, and just subject to whatever happens during the day makes them happy or sad. But Pradeva's approach in shoe meditation is to claim an independence. Dev used to come in the morning in the temple here, and the first word he'd say was Vihayashu. Reading, but it also means contentment. I always think of that in the morning when I get up, and I say, am I content? Yes. Just claim it. You know, just it's a state of consciousness you can claim. You don't have to say no. You know, just find the state of mind which is contentment and experience it. And you get up in the morning and hold it throughout the day. And it's the idea that he was teaching us in shoes, be independent of what happens to us throughout the day, not let it control our state of consciousness.
Just before one merges into the self, and after one comes out of that state. The book was unfolding beautifully, but upon reading what had been written, I thought, this is going to be so difficult for beginning students to understand. There are no words in the English language for what I wish to portray. Unless my students have had deep experiences themselves, it will be difficult for them to believe in the reality of the inner man simply because there are not enough words to describe it. I then began to feel that using Sanskrit might be necessary to find adequate words to convey the meaning of these refined areas of the mind. I thought these areas should have their own names in the same way that emotions and physical things have their own names in English. At our Ascona summer retreat, I began looking through several Sanskrit dictionaries to locate certain words that could be used in the Advaitin. They had a very good library there at the Eranos, Casa Eranos in Ascona. But in three dictionaries, each translator had translated each of the words in a different way. I threw up my hands at this and said, "This is going to make it more confusing." The feeling began to come that what was really needed was another language, a fresh new language, one giving me a vocabulary that we could use to accurately describe inner states of consciousness. 2 or 3 days later, we traveled to Venice, Italy for a few days' excursion. This idea of a new language was still very strongly in my mind. So I went within and wrote down some instructions to my outer self as to how to proceed and where to go to be able to unfold this language. Isn't that an interesting statement? His inner self is writing instructions to his outer self. My instructions were, go within the Uda current. That is the current of mind flow where language exists. In following the instructions, my spine lit up in a beautiful pale yellow and lavender light. The yellow and the lavender intermingled, one color coming in and out of the other. It was just beautiful, but I only found one end of the Uda current and did not have any results in Venice. 3 days later, after returning to Ascona, I found both ends of the Uda current while working within myself. Within 2 hours of meditation, the script, the fundamental alphabet of 18 sounds, and the syntax, as well as some of the basic vocabulary, all came through. The first word to be uttered was shum. Shum now names the language of meditation. As fast as I could, I wrote it all down and ran downstairs to one of the monks shouting, "I have it. I have it. Here is our language." Lost my place. Because I thought I needed only a vocabulary of 50 or 100 words, shum started out in a very simple way. However, in the days that followed, this Uda current became stronger and brighter. I didn't tell anyone about this at the time except for two or three of the Saivite monastics who were with me in Switzerland. I began working day and night. The structure and script for the language began to refine itself, and vocabulary started coming through right from the inner light. I would see light within my head and see little images or letters in the Shum script drop down one after another and line up. Vocabulary flowed out like this for two or three weeks. In Nice, in southern France, the whole concept of Liunasi, the psychic nerve system, and Alikashum, the warmth and psychic heat of the body, came through. Then later on our inner search in Paris, more Shum developed. Upon returning to the United States, I had a vocabulary of about 300 words, and every day even more were coming through. Finally, the images stopped dropping out of the inner light, and I heard the meaning of the words clairaudiently, almost as if someone were speaking to me. Sometimes they would come in reverse, English first, Shum second. The vocabulary and the structure of the language developed very quickly, but what was more important, the perspective of the Shum language was now available. I began to realize that each language has its own point of view or position of awareness that comes into effect when one is speaking that language. In English and other European languages, our awareness is out in the material world. It seems to be located outside of the physical body, looking back at the physical body. From that perspective, a person, if he is daring enough, might be able to fathom the inner areas of the mind like looking through a little keyhole. But often, the external world is so distracting, one does not even bother to try to look within. The meditative perspective of the Shum language is deep within the mind. It is called Shumif. In Shumif, we have the consciousness that we are the center of the universe. We see light within the spine as the central pole, and then open our eyes and look out into the world. Shum has grown into a marvelous teaching tool, because within the structure of the language is contained the entire Advaita Yoga philosophy. It has within it the perspective man had to hold to bring back the great yoga of the ancient rishis. As soon as I released a little bit of Shum to my students, they began teaching it all over the country. Two universities wanted to teach Shum language in their philosophy departments. Working with Shum benefits the individual's natural spiritual unfoldment. It has the effect of harnessing awareness from straying. It is not a quick cure-all for problems of the subconscious mind, nor is it exclusively a mystical set of mantras, although it can be chanted like mantras. Shum is mostly spoken within a person. When a meditator has an inner experience, he can call it by name in Shum and draw a map for himself, showing how to return to the same inner state again. Shum is not designed to replace secular languages like French or English, which are conceived to completely address all the detailed needs and concerns of physical and emotional life. Also, Shum as a working language is still in its formative stages. The following year, we returned to Switzerland, and I experienced the tremendous breakthrough of Mamba Shum. These are Shum maps for meditation that enable a devotee not only to plan out where he is going to go inside before his meditation begins, but also to make memos along the way as it progresses and afterwards when it is done. That year, Nashumif Muling Mishum came through as well. This special collection of Shum words opened the door to speaking Shum during the day. It became possible to remain in inner states while getting things done around the ashram or in the home without having to use another language. It was easy and fun. Nashumif Muling Mishum made things look simple and allowed one to deal with the world without getting drawn too far out into it. That same year in India, I did more work on Shum at Sandakpu, a tiny camp located 12,000 feet high in the Himalayas, 15 miles from the Tibetan border. There, some of the most profound states were unfolded and recorded as Mamba Shum. 65 devotees were with me. Our intense meditations there inspired us deeply. We found that the study of Shum provided concentrated practices and powers better than any other system in the mystical arts and meditation techniques. Mystical experiences began to develop between myself and devotees. As we would go into the same area of the mind and experience, hear the same... Try that one again. Mystical experiences began to develop between myself and devotees. As we would go into the same area of the mind and experience, hear the same sounds and see the same colors. The vibration the language makes when the group is speaking it is in itself uplifting. When chanting Shum, all one has to do is listen inwardly to the tones of the chakras and let one or two out orally while chanting. We made a great study of speaking the Shum language. Students chanting Shum found that just by uttering the tones, awareness was drawn into an expanded state. A mantra vibrates the inner areas of the astral body and the soul body. This allows the soul body to come through the astral into the physical. All this does not have to be understood to occur. It will just happen naturally. You do not have to consciously know the meaning of a Shum chant or even a conversation in Shum for it to have an effect on your inner nerve system. Before the advent of Shum, we did not encourage group meditation. During a group meditation, there were usually several who meditated quite well, while others let their minds wander here and there, going into a half-sleep or becoming distracted. This caused a strange vibration to occur. Now we have very uplifting group meditations in Shum. In fact, at our monastery in Kauai, we begin every day with a long Shiva Puja, followed by a guided group Shum meditation, which lasts about 45 minutes. One person speaking only Shum gently guides the entire group into and out of deep meditation. All individual awarenesses flow into the same areas of the inner mind at the same time. The Shum words give a strong and supportive direction to all present. When this begins to happen successfully, the vibration in the room becomes very strong, more potent, and intensely more satisfying. For the group helps the individual, and the individual helps the group. Isn't that nice? That'd be a great introduction to a book on Shum, I think. You know, it's a first-hand story. What more could you want? So it's hard to remember when we meditated, not in the Shum language, but I have a vague memory of it. It was a very different experience. As Gurudeva points out, there was no shared activity, really. Everyone was just meditating in their own way, in their own direction. And those who were doing well helped the others stay awake. Those who are having trouble staying awake didn't help the others do better. So Shum is good in that it gives everyone a shared concept of what we're experiencing. Very different.
Our regular readers will already have noticed that this installment of Hinduism Today is not in our standard format. It is a special issue entirely devoted to a singular topic, what is Hinduism? Our gatefold, pages 3, 4, and 5, introduces the subject by presenting the voices of prominent Hindu leaders offering their responses to the question. I am sure you will enjoy reading and reflecting on their varied answers, which show clearly the diversity, inclusiveness, and comprehensiveness of the Sanatana Dharma. This magazine is a condensed version of our latest book, What is Hinduism? We wanted to give you, as a reader of Hinduism Today, a sneak preview of the book and share some of its finest chapters. And here is the story behind its creation. All faiths are grappling with their self-definition as we rev up to the breathtaking speed of the information age, a period more intense and kinetic than any other in the history of the world. Teachings and practices that were once accepted without question are often now rejected unless evidence and logic are marshaled to give them plausibility. To survive, customs and traditions must bear up under intellectual scrutiny, must prove themselves helpful and immediately usable. Hinduism is no exception. Hindu education for youth is languishing, and communities around the world are struggling to compose clear, concise presentations of the Dharma. It would be possible to spend an entire lifetime, indeed many lifetimes, absorbing and practicing the teachings of just one sect or sampradaya of the Hindu faith. Yet there remains a need to understand this complex conglomerate as a whole as well. There is a preeminent need the world over for cogent, comprehensive explanations of the various facets of Hinduism and the shared features of its various sects from a mountaintop perspective, to answer the sincere questions of children, co-workers, neighbors, critics, and colleagues, and to provide a non-academic presentation for those of other religions seeking insight into this ancient path. Producing quality educational materials on Hinduism is inherently difficult, precisely because it is one of the world's most paradoxical and easily misunderstood religious traditions. It can be equally confounding to the outsider and to those born in Dharma's embrace. It is accurately a conglomeration, union, a family of many different faiths and practices that share essential characteristics. Most Hindus have an intuitive sense of, but can't articulate the whys and wherefores of their philosophy and practices. The boldness to ask questions about such matters has only recently developed. Just confer with Hindu parents who have stumbled when confronted with the direct and innocent questions posed by their own children. Questions they never voiced, and therefore never learned satisfying answers to. What is Hinduism seeks to be a bridge between generations of past centuries that grew up immersed in a pristine Hindu culture, with vast communal knowledge available to them, and current generations that have little or no access to such knowledge. In those olden times, living in a homogeneous society with the faith, culture, and traditions interwoven in every aspect of daily life, one didn't need to ask the whys of everything. He only needed to participate, enjoy, and absorb the nuances and meanings from the inside out. In today's fragmented societies, we no longer have such cocoon-like training for our children. So teachings must be re-articulated and presented in ways that will make intellectually clear their purpose, relevance, and value in competition with the compelling flood of media that youths and adults are subjected to day after day. Hinduism must also compete in the arena of ideas with its aggressively evangelical counterparts. The idea of creating a book called What is Hinduism came to me from the inner sky one day, while I was meditating on our faith's educational needs. It was as if the inner plane masters, among them our dear Gurudeva, Satguru Sivaya Subramanya Swami, were sending the thought form that such a work would be just what is needed at this time. Approached from scratch, the book in your hands would take years to produce, especially with the amount of patience and care that you will find here in each chapter. Thus, the serendipitous beauty of the project was that the necessary thousands of hours of loving attention had already gone into researching and designing its chapters, as educational insight sections over the last 10 years by the talented team of editors, writers, and photographers of our international magazine, Hinduism Today. All that was needed now, in 2007, was to choose the best features and put them together in a way that offers a highly readable, yet thorough introduction to Hinduism. Voila! As a small group of renunciate Hindu monks at Kauai's Hindu Monastery in Hawaii, we have produced Hinduism Today for more than a quarter century, tracking, monitoring, and encouraging the current renaissance of the grandfather faith of the human race. One of the main reasons Gurudeva founded the magazine was to help Hindus become more aware of the activities of their Hindu brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, and thus draw strength and courage from that knowledge. Another was to dispel myths and misinformation promulgated by invaders and missionaries of alien religions. A third was to present the beliefs and practices common to all Hindus, as well as the teachings and traditions of the individual sects, traditions, and lineages that together form this quilt of Dharma. What is Hinduism is an insider's look, honoring the beauties of culture, tradition, celebration, worship, belief, and discipline. In addition to the reams of scripture available to readers, there are many books on Hinduism by Western scholars and by Eastern writers. But few offer much relief to the parent looking for simple answers or the social studies teacher looking for authentic overview of the faith. Texts by Westerners, often academic in nature, tend to paint Hinduism into the past and distort it by wrong emphasis, dwelling on peripheral, controversial issues such as caste, sati, and the Aryan invasion. Those by Easterners generally focus on just one sampradaya or lineage, such as Shankara and Vedanta, Madhva Vaishnavism, or Saiva Siddhanta, often presenting its philosophy and tradition as if it were the whole of Hinduism, which, of course, it is not. When each sect and lineage is presented in this way, it is no small wonder readers get confused. Rare is the book that presents Hinduism in a comprehensive, contemporary, complementary way as a family of faiths and philosophies that a modern English-speaking audience can relate to, understand, and appreciate. What is Hinduism is just such a rare gem. Exploring it, readers now and then spontaneously stop and sigh, "Ah, now I get it. I now understand this basic concept of Hinduism." It is an authoritative and inspired work, an inclusive, sophisticated, user-friendly explanation of Sanatana Dharma. Far from the arcane sea of text descriptions of Hinduism, this book is rich with potent images, traditional symbols, and photographs depicting each aspect of the culture and faith. If one were to simply study the photos and arts and their captions, that would itself serve as a meaningful glimpse into the Hindu heart. This book is inspired by and draws heavily from the remarkable spiritual legacy of Gurudeva, without doubt one of the most significant Hindu saints and leaders of the 20th century. An American by birth, Gurudeva showed the world by his pure and dedicated life that Hinduism is a vibrant, relevant, and living force. He renewed the pride of Hindus in their faith and gave them guidelines for following Hindu Dharma. He boldly spoke of Hinduism as the greatest religion in the world and showed millions that Hinduism is destined to teach our newly emerging global civilization that coexisting in peace, mutual respect, and with a deep sense of spiritual values is not merely a dream, but a living reality. We know that Gurudeva is smiling approvingly at the creation of What is Hinduism. We believe it will be hailed as a classic and hopefully a bestseller, so that uncounted souls may enjoy its heartfelt messages. In this special issue of the magazine, we present 9 of the 46 chapters from What is Hinduism, which we hope you enjoy as a representative selection that collectively answers this enigmatic question. For a bit more about the book and how to order, see page 16. Don't need that, huh? Did I mispronounce anything? Is it homogeneous? Is that?
Homogeneous.
Did I say homogeneous? I think
yeah.
I did.
Yeah,
homogeneous. Homogeneous.